Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. This is the flagship podcast of the Speculist Weblog. I'm Stephen Gordon. Co-hosting with me tonight is El Jefe himself, the one, the only, Michael Sargent. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Stephen. Thank you for that introduction.
Well, Michael, you were checking on the score for the Rockies and, of course, the Red Sox. What's going on in the game right now?
Well, according to the scoreboard, looks like Boston's up 3-1 at the top of the eighth. So it's not looking good for the home team, but there is still hope.
That's right.
And I've been assured by Phil that he believes that four straight is in the cards and that the Rockies have reproduced the September situation and will sweep the remaining games of their season.
Well, he's a fan. He's a fan to the end, and he's a great fan for them to have. And I was about to say that you must be making the ultimate sacrifice, or either that, or I'm sparing you from some pain by not watching. But you can kind of watch with it on mute, I guess, huh?
Well, like all good baseball fans, I'm horribly superstitious when it comes to watching games on TV, and I have a terrible habit of watching games go down the tubes, so I think I'll avoid.
Oh, well, so you're just going to kind of put the TV to the side, huh? Well, that's great.
Occasionally.
Yeah. Well, Michael has, it's been Phil and I on the Fast Forward Radio show since the very beginning, but Michael has been with us as a blogger at The Speculist all this time, and we're certainly glad to have him on subbing for Phil tonight. Phil is with family, watching this fourth game of the series, and so we wish them luck, and they sure have an underdog status now, but of course they did earlier in the season. You know, they came back from nothing and managed to pull it out, so good luck to the Rockies on that.
Go Rocks.
Yeah, that's right. Well, our listeners can help us with the show this evening by calling in and visiting with us on all the topics we talk about. Our telephone number is 347-215-8972. Well, have you had a big weekend so far other than the game, or what's going on with you, Mike?
Actually, I have. Friday night, I received Phil's kind invitation to go down and check out the Boulder Future Salon, and had a good evening up in the foothills of the Rockies, speaking with a number of interesting folks on the topic of Moore's Law and what it might hold for the immediate and long-term future.
Well, tell us a little bit about that. I mean, this was in Boulder, huh?
It was in Boulder.
Okay. And, is it on a university campus, or where is this?
It actually was held at the Boulder Bookstore, which is an independent bookseller down on the Pearl Street Pedestrian Mall in beautiful downtown Boulder, and I highly recommend both the venue and the group to anybody who might be listening who can make it to the periodic meetings.
Is it more than annually, or how often does the Boulder Future Salon meet?
Normally, they hold monthly meetings on the last Friday of every month. However, in this next month, with the advent of Thanksgiving, they're going to have to bump it up 1 week. That would be 1 week earlier. And the upcoming topic is escaping my mind at the moment.
Okay, that's all right. But y'all talked about Moore's Law this last time.
That's correct.
And, I mean, I understand that there was actually a pretty lively discussion on one issue that I believe maybe Phil brought up. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, Phil kind of got himself in a bit of trouble over not so much Moore's Law itself, but the Turing test and what it may or may not mean for the ultimate advance of computers.
Okay. Okay.
Phil's position was that currently, available systems and the systems developed in the past 50 years have, in the words of one participant, gotten no closer to passing the Turing test, that perhaps that's not necessarily what we are even looking for in an applicable computer or even an artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and he wrote this up at the Speculist, and one of the things he brought up was that, I mean, there were people there that disagreed with even the notion that software has gotten better in the last 30 years. That it, you know, they called it counterfactual when he brought that up, but he wrote it up at the Speculist and actually gave links to the experts that he was quoting. And
I believe the miscommunication there extended primarily in the direction of whether it was all software that has gotten better or relevant software has gotten better.
Relevant to the issue of AI or everything.
Either artificial intelligence or universally applicable software
okay.
functions.
Okay. Well, and basically the notion there was that we've gotten no closer to a solution to the Turing test at all. Phil, I it's so rare that I disagree with Phil, and him not being here, it's a shame that I got to jump out kind of in a different way than Phil did in his Speculist post. But I'm going to go to it real quick and see if I can say what it was that I disagreed with, if I can get to it just real quick. He would basically said that the question, you know, that the Turing test may be the wrong test. Am I misquoting him or misunderstanding what he said? That it may be the wrong thing to ask of AI that they pass
I believe the point of Phil's post, and I think I come down on his side in this one, was that while the Turing test is a nice and relatively easy definition to portray in a public venue,
yeah.
And for those who aren't familiar with what the Turing test might be.
Yeah, please explain that, what that is. What is
Alan Turing proposed that artificial intelligence could be said to have been reached when a jury of interlocutors could sit down at an interface with a computer, and at the time it was a teletype, and hold a conversation on a specific topic with a number of human beings and a computer and be unable to decide which one of the individuals at the other end of the conversation was a computer. Now, over the past 50 years, this test has been attempted multiple times, and at several points, several human beings were decided to be computers by their respective juries, but no computer has ever been mistaken for a human being.
Okay, so no computer has passed the test yet, and people have used this. Critics of the test have said this, you know, have used that fact to criticize the test, and you can kind of see why. I mean, there's a lot has been accomplished since 1950. That's when the test was proposed. That's 57 years ago. You know,
correct.
I mean, you know, the computers that filled rooms back then are less powerful than the laptop I'm using to make the show with. You know.
Reasonably less powerful than your wristwatch, but
yeah, probably even less powerful than my wristwatch. Although I have a pretty old wristwatch, but those machines were very weak by comparison to what we have now, and yet here we are, still not passing the Turing test. And
now I think Phil's reasoning by analogy in his entry, hardware, software, and civilized chimps.
Yeah,
more about which later. I think his reasoning was that the Turing test itself, the full Turing test, being able to discuss with a computer a set topic and not be able to determine whether the entity that you're discussing the topic with is a human being or a computer, is a very powerful and perhaps compelling vision, but just because an artificial intelligence can't pass itself off as human does not necessarily mean it is neither intelligent nor is it in some ways functional or appropriate use of computer technology.
Right. And, you know, and AI research has accomplished a lot, hasn't it? It's just maybe not, you know, we don't have a fully conversational computer. But
among the things that artificial intelligence research has accomplished in the last 57 years is giving us an insight and a window into all of the aspects of human intelligence that we didn't really know about before,
right?
And hadn't really considered being part of the whole package.
Well, you know, if you kind of look at the, let's say it's 1950, Mike. Let's take our Wayback Machine, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And let's forget all that we know about the intervening years, and just we're living in 1950, okay? And you know, the smart guy Alan Turing proposes the Turing test. Why, you know, why wouldn't we think that that test would be passed within a few years? You know, computers, even the computers back then, could do these marvelous things that a human brain could not accomplish. Okay.
Absolutely. The canonical example that comes to mind is the prediction of the outcome of the, I believe it was the 1964 election, in which mainframe computers were used by the networks for the first time to forecast from polling data what the outcome of the election would be. And they predicted a landslide at the time, and it was so unexpected by the pundits at the time that they actually shut the computers down and said, we must have a problem with our programming because this is not the way we expected things to go. When in actual fact, the when all the votes were counted, it was a landslide.
It was the machine that got it right. And
exactly.
Well, you know, it's funny. In recent elections, the machines have not gotten it as right. But, you know, I think
the humans haven't gotten the machines right in recent elections either, but we won't go there.
Well, you know, and I think it's garbage in, garbage out. If you're not putting in the right inputs, then you're not going to get the right result, and that's always going to be the case, isn't it?
Exactly.
Well, but at any rate, with AI, you know, he looked at these marvelous things that these computers could do that human brains could not do, and they figured, well, you know, we just need to teach it how to talk, and it'll pass this Turing test, no problem. It hasn't turned out to be that easy, has it? And I think the main thing is, the main reason is because you need to have a fully sentient being to be able to pass the Turing test.
I think you do. And I think natural human language is a marvelously ambiguous creation, and it can be bent to do a lot of wonderful things. And in fact, that's one of its greatest strengths. But because of that, there is a lot of gray area that a system that is fundamentally logical and algorithmic in its nature can't handle by native brute force processing. I think we're still working out how to work around a lot of those landmines.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just going to take some time, and our understanding of the human brain has, you know, has really taken off in the last 10 years. And I think we're a lot closer now than we would have been 10 years ago. And so I say this is the sort of thing, you know, check in. You know, we're 57 years since it was proposed. Check in with us again in 80 years, huh? And which is just a few years down the road, another 23 years. We can. I think we're looking at something that it may be quite a bit different. So, anyway, that's fascinating, fascinating. But I think that you need a fully sentient being, and so it could be that the Turing test turns out to be the marker, the milestone that really differentiates. You know, here's the singularity. It starts here. Because, you know, once, in order to have a fully sentient intelligence that passes for human, you know, it has to be as smart as a human. And once you get a machine that's as smart as a human, what's to keep it from being just a little bit smart, a little bit smarter than a human?
Absolutely.
And once you get to that point, then you've got machines that are smarter than humans, and that is one of the definitions of the singularity. And so I think it's a major marker. And so just because we haven't reached it doesn't mean it's not possible, and so it's still one of those things that's out there. And it may have been.
Base,
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Michael.
When we touch that base, it won't be very long after that that things do, in fact, get out of hand. I'm reminded of a scenario posed in Eric Drexler's Engines of Creation, where once two artificially intelligent computers are turned on at the same time and connected up, the scientists who invented them then ask them, they've been connected for 1 second, what have you talked about? And the only logical answer that the computers can give is everything, because they will have exchanged more information in that 1 second than the entire human race has exchanged in written or spoken conversation over its entire existence. They're just that much faster than we are.
Well, and I laugh only because, you know, it's a remarkable thing to think about. But I think that once you reach that point, things get weird after that, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't think it's any criticism of the Turing test that it hasn't been reached yet. It's just, in a way, it's a bigger milestone than I think that even Turing understood it to be when he proposed it. So, it must have been a neat meeting in Boulder.
It certainly was, and we had a number of very interesting people at the table, and looking forward to future discussions with them.
Well, one of the people at the table was Douglas Robertson, is that right?
Correct.
And he's a
professor at Colorado State University.
Yeah, written a couple books, hasn't he? What are those books?
University of Colorado, and his publications for the general reading audience are The New Renaissance and Phase Change, and the themes of both of those are the impact of computers and computing technology on human culture, human society. He holds that the advent of the computer and computing technology will be regarded in the future as the beginning of civilization.
Yeah.
Having read the books yet, I can't give you a whole lot of overview about that, but that's an awfully bold statement.
Well, I think that he has some basis for that. I mean, looking back over, the last millennium, watched a program, in the year 2000. They were really going over what's the greatest invention in the last millennium. And they listed off several things, and the computer ranked high in the list, okay? But ultimately, the winner was the printing press, okay? Which makes sense. I mean, that changed everything. And the thing is, we have the benefit of history to look back and see how big of a deal that was. I think at the time, I'm sure that they appreciated they'd done something pretty powerful. It allowed a lot more books to be printed, but I don't know that they really had any understanding how that would change the world. We can look back and see that it did. I think that the computer, the impact of the computer and the internet, will be substantially greater.
I think you're right, and I'm glad you mentioned the internet there, because they are complementary but separate technologies.
Right.
The computer is great at a number of things, but communicating is not one of them. The internet is a workaround for that, and in time, I think it will be proven to be the enabling technology that makes the rest of it work.
Yeah, and again, when the AIs become true sentient general intelligences, the internet's going to be very important to them.
It certainly is, and we've even seen a little bit of harbinger of that in the last week or so with some of the new behaviors ascribed to the Storm botnet worm, if you've been following any of that.
I haven't. Tell me about that.
Apparently, the Storm worm is a computer virus or computer worm capable of setting up operations on infected computers throughout the Internet. and basically time-sharing the computer's central processing unit for the purposes of whoever is in charge of the worm, for lack of a better term, whoever's put it out there. And they can rent this processor power out to the highest bidder for whatever purpose. File sharing has been one of the supposed operations planned for it. But one of the interesting behaviors of this worm that's unusual to the security experts that have been probing it is that as they reach out and probe it, they find systems that are part of this botnet and begin to examine them from a distance using the internet. The reaction of the botnet is to turn all of its resources, or a significant fraction of them, to a distributed denial of service attack against the systems that are probing the botnet.
Wow.
So basically,
if you look at me, I will put you down.
I will turn around and bite you. Yes.
Wow. Yeah. And so in order to bring this thing down, you're going to have also a distributed botnet, basically, to bring down the botnet.
You'll have to have some means of distracting it and attacking it from a different direction, certainly.
Wow. Okay. That sounds like a whole new level. Basically, we'll end up having to, as part of our virus scan thing, we'll probably have to install something that would allow the virus people to, virus scan people to attack virus networks using our computers as their distributed network to be on the side of the good guys. That gets a little bit aggravating, doesn't it?
It certainly does, and this is the first real step, I think, in the direction of an evolutionary arms race in terms of who's going to be in charge of your CPU time.
Oh, yeah. It ought to be the person sitting in front of it. But
I would hope so. I paid enough for it.
Yeah, that's right. and you pay not only for the CPU itself, but also the access to the internet you paid for as well. And so, it's a new form of tyranny. It has to be fought. So, yeah, there's been some other big news this week. Unfortunately, it's better news. Stephen Wolfram, have you kind of looked at this on the Speculist? He wrote an important book a couple of years ago called A New Kind of Science, and fortunately, he's got it up on the internet. You can read it in full if you like. And I think after reading this story, I really need to, and I'm gonna take
I highly
time.
Recommend Wolfram Research's website for a number of publications, but especially that one.
Yeah, and very generous of him to put his book up there. In this book, a few years back, he described a Turing machine that he thought might be universal, and by that he means capable of any kind of computation, and it was the simplest type of a Turing machine possible. Two states, three colors. And in the past, there'd been other computers that were like four states, five colors, things like that. But he had gotten it down to two states, three colors. And he knew that it was impossible to do it any less complicated than that, that a two-state, two-color computer wouldn't work, and so forth. So since he knew that wouldn't work, what's the simplest he could get? Two states, three colors, he picked out one that he felt intuitively was universal, but he couldn't be sure, and so he decided to create a prize. $25,000 is what he offered to somebody who could give him an answer. Is this Turing machine, simple Turing machine, is it universal? Is it capable of any kind of computation? Did you read up on that, Michael?
I did, and one of the figures that sticks out in my mind is that this is not the only two-state, three-color machine possible.
No, not at all.
One of 2,985,984 possible versions of a two-state, three-color machine. So he'd already sifted through nearly 3 million combinations, had a good feeling about it, that this one could possibly be universal. And do you remember what universal indicates in terms of Turing machines?
Right. Capable of any kind of computation. So it could basically be, if a computer can run it, this machine, a machine on based on this architecture could run it, if any machine could.
Exactly.
And so, he, like I said, he had a good feeling about this one, but didn't know and knew it would be a difficult thing to prove it, well, one way or the other. But he just put it out there to the world. Here's the deal. I need this. I need to know, is this a universal machine or not? And $25,000 for yes or no, for a yes or no answer. Well, 47 days is what it took. Somebody gave him his answer in 47 days, and the answer is yes. It is a universal Turing machine, capable of computation, any computation. So I think this is neat on a number of levels. And one thing is that, it is, since it is basically the simplest type of architecture, it would probably be the easiest to reproduce at a very small level, like at the molecular level.
I would think.
You'd come up with some kind of chemical machine that's based on that architecture. You go with simple, and it doesn't get any simpler than that. And so that's potentially an architecture that could be used when making a molecular machine later. And so that's obviously could be huge using that in that way. But it's also, to me, it's just cool because it proves the principle once again of how awesome push prizes or grand challenges or whatever you want to call this when you offer money for science, how that tends to motivate people. And I don't know, maybe that's just the capitalist in me that gets fired up about that. But
I don't know. I think I'd get pretty fired up, too, about making $25,000 in 47 days.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, and obviously it was a guy that was brilliant and had spent a lot of time training himself. And so, he had put his hours in before the 47 days. But, yeah, he was an undergraduate student. This was not, a professor or someone with their doctorate yet. Obviously, a brilliant guy in school, and decided it would be an interesting puzzle. That's what he said, and I guess it was. He managed to prove that it was a universal machine. So that's a neat story.
I think so too. This touches a little on something that we discussed on Friday night too, which was at what point does a computer become impractical or impractically slow. A universal computing machine, a Turing universal machine, can do anything any other computing machine can do.
Yeah.
Just more slowly.
And so, in other words, is he saying that a very simple machine like this, it does it more slowly than a computer based on our architecture today?
By its nature, because it's doing its computations in a step-by-step linear fashion, it is limited to a certain degree to the speed it can achieve. Now,
I guess then the question becomes, well, how parallel could you build a system like that? How many, 2-3 machines could you have running at one time? To make it do something useful, and again, all interesting questions that we can't answer tonight. But
of course,
it's perhaps we'll know at some point.
One of the proposals that came up for a particularly slow machine, however, was if it becomes possible to download human perception. Or download an AI version of yourself, as it were.
Yeah.
If you could run it on a sufficiently slow machine, you would achieve a version of immortality, as long as the machine didn't break down.
Okay. Can you explain why?
Simply because if you could guarantee that the machine would operate continuously but slowly, you could run this simulation of your personality for an arbitrarily long period of time and experience the passage of vast swaths of time from the perspective of inside a very slow box.
Just reading here what Matt, we got Matt in the chat room here, and I'm just kind of reading, seeing what he has. He was saying chemical reactions themselves can perform universal computation. I agree. And the universe itself already does what Stephen Wolfram has suggested. The computational universe is already out there. I mean, do you see it that way, Mike?
I certainly do. I was just going to say that one possible iteration of a Turing machine, whether universal or not, I don't know, is the RNA structure within our own cells, which can read a tape, the RNA molecule,
mm-hmm.
and perform operations on it, producing various proteins or other RNA and even DNA molecules. More code, as it were.
Right. Well, let me give you an example of you were speaking just then about uploading yourself for immortality purposes. I just wonder how rich that experience could be. And let me just give you an example. This weekend, I had a wonderful weekend this weekend. Took my kids to the Louisiana State Fair right here in Shreveport. We did it all, too. I mean, we packed as much as we could in the weekend. Took the kids on the rides. We went to the exhibits. We ate the food. We saw all the new cars that they had prototypes out there, and then went in and saw the animals being displayed. It was like the dog shows where they prance the dogs around in front of the judges and everything. Here it was cattle. Okay. I mean, just had a wonderful day, and you can imagine the richness of the experience. I mean, you're imagine all the smells of the food, the livestock, imagine the experience of going on the rides and everything, and then on top of that, imagine the experience of being with your children, with your family, with good friends that were there with us also. I guess the point, this is a pretty geeky question, but I mean, is there a future out there where all this could be duplicated on a machine? Is love possible within the machine? You see what I'm saying? At any rate, I just wonder, and I guess that's one of the big questions for the future.
I think it is, and the hopeful answer to that is that as long as the ability to download is sufficient in its fidelity, it really wouldn't matter what kind of system you ran it on.
Right.
From within the simulation, you would perceive it as having passed at whatever your normal passage of time might be, even if you were running it on a very simple system and it was only ticking over a new sensory perception every, let's pick an arbitrary time frame, every second.
Yeah.
Which is sort of what the point of the arbitrary lifespan commentary earlier was. From within the simulation, you really wouldn't be able to notice a difference. From outside, it would be passing very slowly.
Right. But from within, you're living for practically forever, right?
So, exactly.
Well, that's interesting. I'm going to bring on another caller here, Mike, and let's see who we have here. Welcome to Fast Forward Radio, caller.
Hello.
Yes.
How you doing? My name is Ism. I'm also a member of the Black Talk family.
Oh yeah, yeah.
How you doing? I'm the Got Cave Radio. I was just interested to hear about the topic about basically a different way of looking at the future.
Right.
I'm a little new to this topic. Can you explain, like, as far as the steps behind, if anyone else can probably, fathom how to, be able to pattern how the future is? Like, how the steps are going?
Well, let's see if we can. Thank you, caller. Mike, tell me, when we're looking at the future, why is it that we think that things like the technological singularity is out there? Thank you, caller.
Well, I think one of the biggest contributors to the perception of a technological singularity, and that's a philosophical hot potato right now, is that we have seen a rate of change over the last 100 to 200 years, even back to the beginning of the Renaissance. It seems to be getting faster and faster. And this rate of change where innovation piles upon innovation and we get a number of different technologies coexisting, competing, and stacking on one another leads to a situation where if the rate of change continues to get faster, not only continues to go on, but continues to get faster, you might reach a point where it's not practical, maybe not even possible, to reliably predict or even have a feeling for what might be coming next. And what might be coming next in the sense of huge changes like computers and the internet and space flight and air flight.
I think one of the biggest drivers of this, caller, is our computers themselves. Okay, our tools, which in intellectual tool, the biggest intellectual tool that we have is a computer. They're getting more and more powerful all the time, and as they get powerful, they assist us in making the next generation of computers. At some point, here's the thought, and this is basically kind of what we were talking about earlier this evening. At some point, if the computers reach a point where they're actually aware, okay, and what I mean by that is that they have as much knowledge as people do, and they are able to think as flexibly about all things as people do, then you reach a point pretty quickly where the beings, either us augmented or computers themselves that are smarter than us, are running the show. At that point, things get pretty weird, and that point has been called the technological singularity. We didn't make that up. That's been around a little while. An author by the name of Werner Vinge, actually I'm mispronouncing his name. It's Werner Vinge, I believe. Benji, any rate, he came up with this about 20 years ago, and that's sort of the basis for what we're talking about.
Definitely a possibility, because we all move into an era where everything is so high tech that and computers are getting smaller to the point where they can be distribute themselves into making their own manufacturing themselves soon. But I think as far as them taking over, it's still the base of life, because we haven't, as humans, found out what created actual life. I mean,
right.
I think once we break that stepping stone, then I believe a computer will take over and we'll start creating. But since we're at a point where we just create at a level where we're still using things that we're not exactly sure where they originated from, we're just using things that we know that are physically there in our presence.
Right.
Generating them just out of anywhere. We can't do that. We get our resources from the earth, and that's basically something that's been here before we were even putting things together, thinking about our technical similarity. But definitely, I think it is getting to the point where they are allowing computers and as far as technology to. I think the specialization is making people less as far as using their mental powers.
Well, I think there's, I think that there's, that is an issue. I mean, to some extent, we rely on them, but at the same time, people have become more efficient. And I mean, I've seen studies on this recently that people are able to get more work done, and in part, this is because obviously the machines we have machines that are allowing us to do things that we could not do before. Thank you, caller. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Dave Radio.
All right.
I think his point's well taken, that we haven't yet hit a level where we can confidently say we know enough about creating things and creating new patterns that we will have a good enough grasp to go the next step and create an artificial intelligence, an artificial person, anytime in the near future.
Right.
In my lifetime.
Yeah. This obviously is on down the road. And one of the things that, I think may help us is to understand our own brains more. You know, understand what's going on in our, in our skulls. You know, and our understanding of that is improving all the time. We've got functional MRIs now that show actual chemical changes taking place in real time, and that's just within the last couple of years. And as the resolution on that improves, and as we can see what's going on inside our heads in real time, I think that our ability to model that and to turn that around and use that to actually help us create an AGI. What I mean by that is artificial general intelligence. I think that would be instrumental in helping us to create that.
I think you're right. One of the issues that we tossed around a little was at what level would it be necessary, or do we think generally would it be necessary to simulate the operations of the human brain before you get that AGI? Do you have to go all the way down to the molecular chemical level, or even below to the subatomic level, to get all of the functions right? And if so, this has implications on exactly how big a computing device you need to run that simulation at an arbitrary level of speed and fidelity.
And can you get what you need without a destructive scan? I think that's an important issue as well. Would you have to do a destructive scan in order to upload somebody into a computer? And
hopefully not a destructive scan of an operational piece of equipment.
Yeah. Exactly. An operating brain. It would be one thing to do a destructive scan on someone who's dead. It'd be a whole other thing to do a destructive scan on somebody who's sitting there in the chair, healthy and alive. And so, what mad scientist is going to do that? There are some serious ethical concerns there, don't you?
Absolutely.
Don't you think, Mike? And so, yeah. All interesting stuff. I want to hit on a couple more stories, and before we close the show out, we just have a few more minutes. And so, but did you catch the artery micro cyborg robot story earlier this week?
I certainly did. I think we're headed in the right direction here.
This is a good thing. This is a very good thing. This is not a nanobot that they described, okay? But and it's not just a description either. I shouldn't say description. This is a functional prototype that they showed. It's a little smaller than a millimeter, and a millimeter. Most of our audience is going to know what a millimeter is, but I mean,
this is smaller than most ants.
Yeah, take your fingers and look up at the light and hold your fingers as close as you can possibly get while the light still shines through without allowing your fingers to touch. That's basically a millimeter, okay? This thing is slightly smaller than that, and it can fit within an artery, and it moves with heart muscle. That is pretty cool to me. They take heart muscle, cultivated from the patient himself or herself, and they use the heart muscle to and put it on the machine. So that's why I'm calling it a cyborg. It's not just entirely a metal or silicon machine. This is biological as well. And they use that for locomotion. And so it doesn't need a battery. It operates the same as the rest of the body. Same chemical system that's used to run all the cells of your body, the ATP to ADP, is used by that heart muscle as it moves this little robot through the arteries, clearing out the arteries of plaque and fat and all the things that causes heart attacks after 40. That we need to, and this is, like I say, this is a wonderful, like Mike said, this is a wonderful thing. We need a few, I think probably pretty much everyone who's had you know, a hamburger or two in their life probably could use a few of these. And of course, we had some commenters, I believe, in that to that story who said, you know, this, I don't think I'd want one of these things wandering around in my body without, you know, a guarantee of safety. I took a little bit of issue with that, Mike. Do you? I mean, how do you feel about that? I mean, is to me, medicine never can guarantee safety.
Like any other therapeutic device, I think not only should it be, but it will be thoroughly tested, possibly
right.
To its detriment. But I think overall, something like this technology, some sort of micro electromechanical system, is probably coming to an artery near you sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and people that you know assume are healthy may need these things as much as anybody else with heart
perhaps
disease.
Perhaps more so.
Yeah, perhaps you know with heart disease. With heart disease, sometimes the first symptom has been in the past at least the first symptom is sudden death. And you know, I hate to bring up something that's such a downer, but that's just the case, you know.
Well, let me throw a slightly more positive spin on that. As somebody who lives in the same household as a cyborg, you know, sign me up. I think we're beginning to come into, if not the beginning of civilization, as Professor Roberts has it, certainly the beginning of modern civilization and modern medicine, where we can get some firsthand experience, some sensors on the ground, and get a good look at what's going on instead of having to rely on second and third hand reporting from your own body's reactions to things that are going on inside it.
Right. And yeah, I would if you could just have something the size of a PDA in your pocket that's communicating with these little bots inside you and saying, okay, here's the issue, here's how it needs to be dealt with. You know, we could be much more proactive in taking care of ourselves. You know, your body could be informing you what vitamins and minerals it's lacking, or this or that, and what would be a good meal to have.
However,
we could ignore that when we wanted a cheeseburger. But I mean, you know, we would at least have the information to make an intelligent decision if we chose to.
And I'll take the role of devil's advocate here. Whatever it's telling you, it may also be telling me. Insurance company, your employer, and your doctor,
right.
And what they do with that information might or might not be something that you would choose for them to do.
Well, that's going to be another area that we got to fight for our rights to privacy. I mean, we got to I think we can be boosters of the technology while at the same time realizing that there's a dark side to it. You know,
the first step in the battle for privacy is being aware of where the leaks might be.
Hey, I'm going to steal that. I'm going to make that my own, Mike. I appreciate that. That's a great comment. But anyway, right. Understanding the technology and knowing where things are going, I mean, that's absolutely essential, which is one of the reasons we enjoy doing this show so much.
We enjoy bringing it to all of our readers and listeners, and we do it as much for the intellectual exercise as for any audience, but it sure is good to hear callers and commenters on the blog on a regular basis.
Well, let me go ahead and open up because we do have a few more minutes, and I think Matt's still out there in the chat room. Matt, if you would like to call in, or anybody else that's listening would like to call in before we wrap this show up, the number is 347-215-8972. And we can visit about all the stuff we've talked about, or we'll just open up the subjects to anything you want to talk about. If it's futuristic, we'll visit about it. But what else did y'all cover? Anything besides the Moore's Law at the Boulder Future Conference, Mike?
Let me touch a little bit about Moore's Law, particularly. One of the things that came out of the tremendous amount of background reading material that Wayne Rudinsky, the moderator for the evening and one of the founders of the Salon, presented to us, was that Moore's Law itself has gone through a number of metamorphoses in its existence, and in fact was never really a validly constituted, if you will, scientific or engineering law. It was much more of a an observation and a rule of thumb. And in that period of time, the 30 years since it's been really come to the fore of the public attention, it's become something of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
The original formulation of Moore's Law was much more to the effect of looking back over the last 10 years, and that being from a position in the late 1960s,
mm-hmm.
We have seen that from the first transistor-based integrated circuit to that point, the number of silicon devices has roughly doubled every year. Projecting this forward into the future would indicate that that the optimum, i.e. cheapest and most efficiently spaced devices in 1975 will be approximately 65,000 components, give or take, and what that means for the utility of these particular chips, Moore had very little to say, just that there would be these many devices on a chip of roughly the same scale that they were talking about at the time, which was only 1 square inch.
Yeah.
And the dice, the individual computer components in most desktop computers are 1 square inch, give or take, half an order of magnitude or so.
Right.
But the point here was that Moore, as an engineer, was projecting forward from past experience and not really making a whole lot of prediction as to what this system might be used for. But in the interim, in the 30 years that this eponymous law has been bandied about, people have taken it to indicate any number of things, to include computers doubling in performance, and the definition of performance is a notoriously slippery one.
Right.
every 12 to 18 months, or the cost of an arbitrary level of technology, an arbitrary number of components, or an arbitrary performance level, being halved every 18 to 24 months, and in the latter stages, even Moore was inclined to cite a 36-month doubling period.
And what this is, obviously, is it's the number of transistors you can get on an integrated circuit. He's saying, you know, we're going to be doubling these every, I think, 18 months initially, and then now he's saying, what, every 36 months? Is that what that?
I believe Moore's last variation on the theme was 48 months.
Okay, so he's getting a little more conservative in his old age, it sounds like. But obviously, so we're not talking about any other form of computation other than the integrated chip. He was not saying anything about what was going on before the integrated chip with vacuum tube-based computers or relay-based computers even before that. He was not saying anything about what might happen afterwards. But Kurzweil and others like him have taken that and said, and said, okay, Moore's Law just deals, obviously, with integrated circuits, but there's a broader thing to look at here. You know, we can look at the, you know, from the moment of the Big Bang, the universe, has come forward, and, you know, first there was biology, computation in biology. You mentioned DNA and RNA earlier, Mike, and then computation within brains that were built from biology. That was the next thing after that, and then computation that we did by hand or now on paper, and then finally, you know, slide rules and things like that, and on until now we're each paradigm gives birth to the next paradigm, and right now we're within the Moore's Law paradigm, I guess. We do have another caller, and so let's see. This might be Matt. Let's see who we got. is. Welcome to Fast Forward Radio. Is this Matt?
Yes, it is.
Oh, hi, Matt. How are you today?
Hi, I'm good.
Okay, good.
Mike, I just want to get back to the point you're talking about with the Turing test.
Okay.
I think that would be a good indicator of consciousness, but I don't think necessarily general intelligence.
Okay. Well, explain the difference between consciousness and general intelligence and why Turing would test for one but not the other.
Kind of a difficult question, but I think I kind of go along with Eliezer Gadkowski's thinking with this, that a human level of language wouldn't necessarily be the only thing that a general intelligence could be that would be a characteristic of general intelligence, that it could do things basically by mathematical inference.
Right. I think that was part of the point that Phil made, and I was trying to understand within Phil's post earlier, Mike, was that, conversation and thinking like a human may not be the way to go on, maybe the test is all wrong because of that basis. Maybe we're looking for the wrong markers for consciousness.
That's perhaps the case. I think Matt's point is well taken, and perhaps as an example of it, it would be very nice for a computing device of some sort to wake up tomorrow morning and tell us, I think, therefore I am.
Right.
But that level of mastery of language is not required to be either a conscious or a thinking entity.
Right. We don't require that level of mastery before we start thinking of humans as important people. Children.
Except in undergraduate philosophy programs, I think you're right.
Yeah, that's right. No doubt. Well, am I characterizing your point correctly, Matt?
Yes, I think so. Back in the perspective of 1950, I think Turing might have been underestimating what an artificial intelligence could be. There's many variations that it's all based on its design, that there's a huge number of possibilities, and it's not just something that would normally be portrayed on sci-fi, such as HAL or whatever.
Yeah. Well, and you know, that of all the possible artificial general intelligence that could be out there, let's hope that we don't go the HAL route, right? We want a friendly artificial general intelligence, even if it's very alien in the way it thinks by comparison to humans. Alien's okay, but friendly is absolutely essential from our point of view.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Yeah.
Was
that your point, Matt?
Yes.
Okay. Well, as always, we enjoy getting your calls. Please call again next week. You always liven up the discussion. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, Mike, I think we are in the last moments of our program tonight.
I'm disappointed to hear that on one hand. On the other hand, I just checked the scoreboard at Coors Field, and Boston's still ahead, up by one run in the middle of the ninth. Hope remains alive in Denver, and
Phil, if you're listening, we're with you, man. We want your guys to come back from the brink of defeat and shock the world. That would be awesome. So, anyway, we will be back next week, same time, same place. We air every at Blog Talk Radio. Every Sunday night, 11 Eastern, 10 Central, 9 Mountain, 8 Pacific. And you want to check out our exit music this evening. It's pretty entertaining. The band is called Uncle Seth. The song is "You Don't Need an iPod," and it's perfect for this show. And so listen in on this. But anyway, it's been a great night, Mike, and I appreciate you filling in. I believe that you'll be filling in next week as well, if you're available.
I would be more than happy to.
Oh, that's great.
Thank you for the fantastic introduction to Blog Talk Radio.
Well, thank you for being with us tonight. All right. Good night.
Good night.
Okay, we're having a little problem with our music here. Let me try that again.